And from petition.
May it please the court, Mr. Prosperity, and Mr. Crumble, the lawyer for the petitioner, Mr. Prosperity, will open the...
May it please the court. This is a will contest case tried before a jury in the 155th Judicial District Court of Fayette County, Texas. It's actually a retrial or second trial of the case involving the same parties. The first case having been won by the petitioners as contestants, appealed by the respondents as appellants, and reversed and remanded by the Beaumont Court of Civil Appeals upon after a transfer by this court from the Austin Court of Civil Appeals, calling for a new trial, and this is that new trial. Points of error to be presented to the court are those on which the court has granted our application for the error. The first point being that the Austin Court of Civil Appeals erred in denying our third motion for extension of time to file a statement of facts and an overruling petitioner's motion for rehearing of that order. The second point of error being the Court of Civil Appeals erred in granting respondents' motion to dismiss for warrant of prosecution upon a motion of the respondents in this case and dismissing the petitioner's appeal. With the permission of the court and with the prior assistance of the marshal, we have placed before the court a handout listing the chronology of the dates involved here from the day of the signing of the judgment by the trial court judge through and including the actual filing of the application for writ of error. There is a table at the bottom of that handout which I will discuss in a few moments. It is undisputed by all of the parties in this case that all of the prerequisites to perfecting the appeal to the Court of Civil Appeals were duly and timely performed, with the sole exception of the filing of the statement of facts of the record in this case. The statement of facts was due on April 7th of 1980. Prior to that time, and with the idea that we would have to file a motion for extension of time, I approached the court reporter and inquired as to his estimate of how long it would take him to prepare the record, what the record would consist of in terms of size, for a very good reason. In the first trial of this case, it took this same court reporter 353 days to complete the record. He did not even begin on the statement of facts until 8 or 9 months after it was due. This is in the first case. It was anticipated that it would take him a significant length of time within which to complete the statement of facts in the second trial because it involved a 10-day trial with the testimony of four doctors, and it was going to, we felt, take him that length of, an extended length of time. With that in mind, we filed our first motion for extension of time duly and timely with the Austin Court of Civil Appeals, asking for the 180 days, attaching a copy of the reporter's affidavit, which recited that he did have, in fact, a heavy caseload, a backlog of appeals and records to prepare. And the court granted that motion, allowing us an extension of 60 days. The respondent's motion in opposition to our motion, our first motion, recited and conceded that it, in fact, would probably take 180 days to complete the record. But they wanted the court to require a progress report from the court reporter and also to shorten the length of time involved. It became necessary to file a second motion for extension of time to file a statement of facts, which we did duly and timely. And we were asking at that time for 120 days, having shortened our request. The motion in opposition filed by respondents to that second motion once again recited and conceded that it would probably take 180 days for the court reporter to prepare the statement of facts, but they wanted to shorten the time and here again a progress report. In both of their motions in opposition, they referred to and attached a copy of a per curiam opinion issued out of the Beaumont Court of Civil Appeals in the first case. The per curiam opinion came 8 or 9 months after the due date of the statement of facts in the first case. And the Beaumont Court issued an opinion which said that they had the authority under Articles 1823 and 1824. And the case of City of Ingleside versus Johnson, this is part of our part of the record in this case, to issue mandamus-like orders, which they did, requiring the court reporter to file an affidavit on a weekly basis, certifying to the number of hours that he spent in preparing the record in that case, also certifying to the number of hours that he had used in preparing or performing other official duties not related to preparing the record, and recited in their third paragraph of that per curiam opinion that should the court reporter fail or refuse to file the affidavits as required, then the appellants, the respondents in this case, were invited to file a petition for writ of mandamus, and should they fail to do so, that this would be taken into consideration in granting further motions for extension of time. The Court of Austin Court of Civil Appeals, in granting our second motion, adopted the latter part of the language of the Beaumont Court of Civil Appeals and recited, although they did not issue the sanctions requiring a weekly affidavit, the sanctions which they ordered were, should the court reporter fail or refuse to file or complete the statement of facts by July 24, 1980, then the petitioners, in this case, were invited to file a petition for writ of mandamus. Failure to do so would be taken into consideration in granting or denying further motions for extension of time. So they, in effect, disregarded the first portion of the Beaumont Court of Civil Appeals sanctions and went right to the point of saying, we want you to file a petition for writ of mandamus. The opinion of the Austin Court of Civil Appeals incorporating this language from Beaumont Court was issued July the 2nd, 1980, extending our time to July 24th, 1980. They gave us an additional 48 days, or a total of 108 days. It was apparent at that time that it was going to be impossible for the court reporter to complete the statement of facts by July 24th. This was apparent on the face of the record in view of the fact that the affidavit that we had attached to our second motion recited that the reporter had not even begun the statement of facts. The question was then posed as to whether or not we should in fact file a petition for writ of mandamus, as we were invited to do. What the Austin Court of Civil Appeals was really asking, were they pressuring the court reporter at that time, or were they asking us to, in effect, do everything we could to get the record prepared? It was our feeling that a writ of mandamus at the time would have been futile and useless for some very important reasons. First of all, we felt that the Austin Court wanted the record, as did we, and that a writ of mandamus, a motion for leave to file a petition for writ of mandamus, would have further delayed the appeal in the appellate process and the obtaining of the record. Secondly, the Austin Court disregarded the prior sanctions of the Beaumont Court in adopting their opinion and requiring the court reporter to file weekly affidavits. We felt that the only remedy that the court or that action that the court could have taken at that point, had we filed a writ of mandamus proceeding and the court granted it, was to incarcerate the court reporter. We felt like the court reporter, based on his affidavits, was doing everything possible to complete the record. Nothing during this entire time the petitioners failed to do or did caused the record not to be filed. We were at the mercy of either the court reporter in preparing the record on the one hand, or the Austin Court of Civil Appeals in allowing us our extensions of time. Thirdly, the question is posed as to whether or not we are required by the rules to file the petition for writ of mandamus. We filed all of our motions under Rule 21C, reasonably explaining the need for the extension. Whether or not the court should, on its own initiative, issue a writ of mandamus, like sanctions or orders, such as the Beaumont Court did in the first trial, or whether or not they should require the petitioners to seek a petition for writ of mandamus, in addition to a motion reasonably explaining their need for motions for extension of time, is another question that's posed. Finally, and very importantly, the court reporter during this period of time became ill. On July 13th or 14th, he required nasal surgery in Austin and suffered a relapse shortly thereafter, requiring hospitalization being hospitalized in LaGrange, Texas. His day-to-day schedule from June the 2nd through August the 27th, 1980, was attached in an affidavit by him to our motion for reconsideration of the order of the Austin Court of Civil Appeals denying our third motion. And it recites in there, and the court reporter swears that during this period of time he was unable to perform official duties of any kind, for a period of approximately 15 days. During this critical period of time between the filing of the second motion and the filing of the third motion. For all these reasons, we felt that the petition for writ of mandamus would not be the remedy that we should seek, that the Austin Court of Civil Appeals has said that, or did say that they would consider this as one factor in granting further motions for extension of time. We did, in lieu of filing a petition for writ of mandamus, file a third motion for extension of time, attaching the affidavit of the reporter, and the affidavit shows that the court reporter, in fact, had begun the statement of facts.
Now, what was that date when he began about?
We filed the third motion, Your Honor, for extension on July 28th. So sometime prior to July 28th, the court reporter had begun the statement of facts in this case.
That was more than 6 months after the judgment.
Yes, sir. The statement of facts was due on April the 7th. It was approximately.
I'm just curious to know how long it was approximately from judgment until the court reporter started work.
Yes, sir. Well, the judgment was signed by the trial court on January the 9th, 1980. The statement of facts was due on April the 7th. So within a period of, from the date of the due date until we filed our third motion, the court reporter had begun the statement, or within a period of 90 days. As contrasted with the first case where he didn't even begin the statement of facts until the 8th, 9th, or 10th month.
He began at the 6th month here.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
He began it on the 6th month.
After the judgment. That's correct. But within 9 days after the actual due date of the statement of facts on April the 7th. In that affidavit, he further recited that he had one criminal case pending and 5 pleas of privilege. The court denied our third motion, and we therefore filed what we entitled a motion for reconsideration of their order overruling our motion for denying our third motion. As I've stated, attaching a copy of the reporter's affidavit, which gave his day-to-day schedule, from June the 2nd to August 27th. That affidavit also recited that he had completed over one half of the statement of facts as originally estimated at that time, which at this time, the date of filing was September the 9th, 1980. The court denied our motion, our third motion on August the 26th, 1980. At the same time, because presumably, since we had failed to accept their invitation to file the petition for writ of mandamus, we did in fact file on that same date that motion for leave to file a petition for writ of mandamus with a petition attached. The court denied that motion also. The record...
matter of mechanics, was the writ of mandamus filed originally in the Court of Civil Appeals?
The writ of mandamus was filed in the Court of Civil Appeals, yes, as they requested and invited us to do in their second opinion granting our second motion. We subsequently filed a petition for writ of mandamus in the Supreme Court seeking to get the Court of Civil Appeals to allow us to obtain the record or to file a record to perfect our appeal.
I think I have the Court of Civil Appeals unpublished opinion before me, and it doesn't say where to file a motion for mandamus. Just invite you to file one somewhere.
Yes, sir. That's correct.
And you construe that to mean in the Court of Civil Appeals?
Yes, sir. Only because they had the Beaumont Court of Civil Appeals procuring opinion before them, and they adopted verbatim the language from that opinion.
Correct me that more likely it should have been filed in the trial court where you can take testimony when you listen to it.
That never occurred to me, Judge Ed. I felt that they wanted us to file it with them so that they could take an action to preserve their, or try to get their record completed. The statement of facts was completed. This is outside the record. It was part of the writ of mandamus proceedings or filings, but it's not part of this record. On October the 28th, 1980, 204 days after the due date, 96 days after the second extended time, if the Austin Court of Civil Appeals had granted our third motion, in effect, which we asked for a reduced amount of time to file our statement, with 90 days, it was felt that the court reporter would have completed it within that time frame. As it turns out, they denied the third motion, so it's a moot question. But the record did ultimately consist of 2,019 pages and over 500 exhibits.
Who is the trial judge that presides over
Fayette County,
where this court reporter is?
Oliver Kitzman. The draw the attention of the court to the table at the bottom of the handout where I show a discretion comparison between the first case appeal and the second case appeal. First case, the Austin Court of Civil Appeals granted two motions for extensions totaling 248 days. Without any additional sanctions or without any invitation to file a petition for writ of mandamus, without anything. This court then transferred the case to Beaumont Court of Civil Appeals. They in turn granted three additional extensions of time for a grand total of 353 days prior to the actual filing of the statement of facts. We have been granted in the second case two motions for extension of time totaling 108 days. It's my feeling that this wide disparity of the exercise of discretion in the same case involving the same parties of a record that's approximately the same size falls within the wording of the...
You suppose they were trying to avoid that 8-month delay?
Your Honor, I certainly feel that they
I'm
had...
I'm not saying who's to blame for it, but I'm trying to...
I think that was a consideration when they issued their...
It really didn't take him too long to write your record once he got started.
Once he got started, that's correct. And that was true both in the first trial and the second trial. This is why we felt that since he had begun the statement of facts, and we recited that, or he recited that in his affidavit, which was attached to our third motion for extension, that this would represent to the court that, okay, the court reporter has started the record just like he did in the second case. There's no more foot dragging. He's not going to be...
I believe if I'd been on the Court of Civil Appeals, I'd have said that in this first order, that your time for starting begins now.
Yes. I don't disagree with the urgency on the part of the Austin Court of Civil Appeals in view of the fact of the prior problems with the same court reporter. I do take issue with the fact that they're requiring additional sanctions on the part of the petitioners to seek the record when we have reasonably explained, as required by Rule 21C, the need for additional extensions of time.
But you kind of defied the Court of Civil Appeals, didn't you?
Your Honor, I did for the reasons that I've set out. I felt that because they were issued the opinion on July the 2nd and had extended the time to July 24th, when both the petitioners and respondents agreed that it was going to take probably 180 days for the court reporter to prepare the record, I was trying to determine what the Austin court was really saying, because obviously it was not going to be completed by July 24th when it had not even begun. So what were they really saying?
Like they might have been saying to you, we need your help in getting this thing going.
The question then is posed is whether or not they, like the Beaumont Court, should or could initiate the sanctions on their own initiative, or should require petitioners to, we felt, incarcerate the court reporter, which we felt was the only sanctions left for them to do, since they had not adopted the sanctions of the Beaumont Court in requiring the court reporter to file a weekly affidavit and so forth. We did subsequently file a motion for leave to file a petition of writ of mandamus on September the 9th. They overruled that motion. For the balance of the argument, would at this time present Mr. Conzer. Thank you.
Thank you,
Counselor.
Again, at 11:15, did they not?
There's 7 minutes left in the clock.
Okay, you got a blue light, but I don't guess the co-counsel saw it.
Good. Please the court. My name is Jim Bronzer, and I'm pleased to be here for a very specific reason. I thought up until this week that I would be here by myself. Wayne Busbury has been a friend of mine for a number of years, and as the court already knows, he had a heart attack in June, and then he had a open heart surgery just 2 weeks ago, but he wanted to be here, and so I won't have to do a lot of the load carrying.
Who is this?
This gentleman right here.
Well, I shouldn't have been so rough.
So, no, well, I almost got up, Judge, but his doctor told him he's in good shape, and it's amazing what they can do now. It's amazing. Triple bypass, but let me say, though, I guess I probably should have reverted to Trump's once said, when I really don't have much to add, I'll sit down, and mostly what I have to say today relates to a number of discussions that I've been fortunate enough in my time to have with the court as a member of the advisory committee concerning this never-ending problem with court reporters, and the unhappiness that's obviously reflected in this record by the Austin Court of Civil Appeals. And that's really what it all gets down to. The Judge Polk has offered you many times on sheriffs and constables and court reporters, and they live under the aegis and the autumnal protection of their district judges. And when you're in a single county district, you don't want rough them up too bad. You got to be back there, hopefully. That's what he hopes. His record's made. So when you start mandamusing them and putting them in jail and fining them and punishing them, it sort of takes a little bit of courage. And so when he knew he couldn't complete the record, he didn't want to do what may not be legal. Now, I want to answer a question that Judge Greenhill posed. This device arose in the fertile mind of Judge Keith, who I saw across the hall this morning, in the first trial of this case. He based the power of the intermediate court to issue a mandamus on the Ingleside versus Johnson, which is not a case dealing with forcing the court reporter to make a record at all, but it involves a ministerial act of the court reporter not being willing to start the record or release the record until he got paid for it. Now, that is an act upon which the power of the Court of Civil Appeals can act. Now, he did do his own thing, four or five of these steps, report every week, how much pages you've done, even without a mandamus of power in that case. And it's clear, Your Honor, Judge Greenhill, that he meant, and the Austin Court meant to address this mandamus power to them and not to the district court, where I think if there is such a power, it has to reside. And let me say why I know that, or why I suspect that's true. Subsequently, in another case, O'Neill versus Stovall, which we cited in our previous submission brief, the Austin Court just took bodily that same principle, same language from Judge Keith in this first appeal, applied it in that case. In that instance, the moving party did seek the mandamus in that court. The court reporter finally got something, a piece of something up there, and they then, that court granted the new trial on the grounds that the moving party had exhausted all possible remedies and had therefore satisfied the rule that he's entitled to a new trial if he can't get a complete record. Now let me say that before I sit down at this time. I don't think, when we're talking about what this court has said in numerous opinions, that a party is entitled to his record, and if he really uses diligence and can't get it, that then he's entitled to a new trial for that. Either death of the reporter, the judge can't remember what happened, or some reason of that type where you just can't make a record. Robinson versus Robinson in 487 second by this court is the leading case. That you can get a new trial just because you can't get a record. And there, yes, you would have to show, Mr. Chief Justice, maximum diligence. And perhaps it would be appropriate to impose an additional constraint and restraint upon the person seeking that relief. That's not what the Walters receive. They want their appeal. They don't ask for extraordinary relief of that type. What I'm here for, and if I say I press them up, something saying I shouldn't say. Rule 21C in Meshwork and Meshwork very clear, has a very clear purpose in backing off of Matlock. And this is a superimposition of another one of another inhibition on record making on the part of the litigant. Now, there's been much debate over the years that after a certain time, as in some jurisdictions, after a period of time, the duty to hustle up the court reporter ought to be cast to the other side. Guarantee you they'd get made up some way then. Mark Martin has espoused that for 10 years. That after 100 days, just flip it over and see if you don't get a record pretty quick that there was a burden, or else you get a new trial. That the original appealing party doesn't have that burden. Now, I'm really saying
I have never seen any proposed rule that states sanctions which might be invoked against a court reporter. Certainly there need to be some sanctions.
Judge, I don't quarrel with that. You know that. I've been there with you. But what I am saying,
I'd like to see a kind of a rule that
that's what I say. We may be talking about, but what I'm saying here, Meshwork and 21C were hard fought out over a long period of time to impose the burden upon the moving party to reasonably explain. Now, if he has got to go beyond that, not only reasonably explain why he can't get it, the affidavits with the reporter, who has sworn under his oath what he can do and can't do, and has got to move to invoke the jurisdiction to grant an extraordinary writ, probably if the court pleases, of the district court, because I don't think the Court of Civil Appeals can do it. Because he's got a police. Somebody's got to police him. And that is discretionary, how he's doing it. But it's got to be done below to do it. But to impose that additional restraint, if Your Honor please, is a way back off of the mesh work in Rule 21.21c. And I say that if you permit, after that struggle, that long, to protect the right of appeal, to let new rules be written on that rule, or old, for a new line into that old case, that it will be a mighty step backwards. And I hope that you don't do it. It may be if he were seeking to get a new trial for this reason.
Counsel, your time.
Oh, I'm sorry. Right. I apologize. It's
all right. You have a response. The argument and response.
If it pleases the court, I'm Tom Robinson from Gonzales. We represent the appellees, the proponents in the will contest out of Fayette County. This was the second trial, the jury answering the special issues in favor of the proponents on the second trial with an appeal by the appellants and contestants below to the Austin Court of Civil Appeals. The chronological outline that Mr. Prosperi has handed you is correct. The appellants came into the Austin Court of Civil Appeals when their time was about to expire of 60 days to file that statement of facts. They filed that first motion for extension of time and it was granted. They had to come back, and at the second time, they asked the court on a second motion to extend the time for filing the statement of facts again. At that time, there was an affidavit attached to that motion by the court reporter. And if my memory serves me right, that affidavit does not say whether or not Mr. Baker, the court reporter, had even begun the statement of facts. In the third motion to extend time, it was filed July 28th, there is a statement in there that he has begun, but we do not know what progress has been made. Mr. Prosper is right. We did oppose those motions because we had this same experience with Mr. Baker before in the Beaumont Court of Civil Appeals, and we had gone through the whole deal with Mr. Baker one time before, and we foresaw this. The Austin Court of Civil Appeals also saw that there was going to be a problem, and on July the 2nd, 1980, that court issued its per curiam order inviting the appellants to file their application for writ of error. To file their application for writ of mandamus against that court reporter. They ordered the statement of facts filed by July the 24th, and they waited. The appellants did nothing. It was plain to us. We had no problem with that. We knew what they had to do. We knew that the Austin Court of Civil Appeals knew there was going to be a problem, and that somebody was going to have to do something about Mr. Baker to spur him on and to get him to go to work. July 24th came and went, and under date of July 26th, and I believe filed on July 28th, the appellants filed a third motion for extension of time.
Did you file an answer in this case?
Sir?
Did you file any answer?
Yes.
Any brief? I didn't get them.
To the writ of error, yes, sir.
Go ahead.
While you're interrupting,
yes.
Do you have a clue as to where the Court of Civil Appeals thought the mandamus should be filed? Should the reporter fail or refuse to complete the statement of facts, appellants are invited to file a motion for leave to file a petition for mandamus.
To me,
in that court, are invited to get busy in the district court?
I think they were asked to file it in the Austin Court of Civil Appeals. And they told them that would be taken into consideration in the granting of future motions. And I think that their thought, and it was ours, that it had to be filed at or prior to the filing of another motion to extend time.
Counsel, let me tell you, I want to disclose to you what's bothering me about this. The system has failed. And the one who's suffering hasn't done anything particularly wrong except to say I want a record and I'll pay for it. But the system has wholly failed and an appeal has been lodged.
But Judge Polk, couldn't the individual who's saying that have filed that application for mandamus and given that court an opportunity
give Mr. Baker free room and board, a dictaphone, and a typewriter to get that record out.
But the one who's least at fault is the one who is thrust with the burden of doing all of these things. We have a public official who's sworn to get out a record.
The appellant is thrust with the burden of enforcing that and seeing to it that the court reporter, if the appellant doesn't do it, who is to do it? The appellees probably, they're not going to do it. The Court of Civil Appeals would like to see the record filed, but can the Court of Civil Appeals come down and do it to the court reporter? I think the Court of Civil Appeals has to be helped along here. He has to have help by the appellant and their attorneys. And I think that's...
Doesn't the lawyer who invokes those sanctions and encourages the Court of Civil Appeals to put a court reporter in jail, doesn't that counsel endanger his future chances of ever practicing law in that court again? If not from the court reporter, maybe from the trial judge himself. Doesn't that place an awful burden on appellants? And consider this. Suppose a record is not made through no fault of the appellee, and a new trial is granted because the record is not available. And the appellee is the one that is punished. So it's a sword that cuts two ways. The problem is the court reporter. The one at fault seems to be insulated from everyone, and yet it's either the appellant or the appellee that are going to suffer. Now, what's the answer to it?
On a retrial or in future cases in that county?
Either way, probably both. Don't you think the lawyer runs a risk when he wants to put a court reporter in jail of ever going back and practicing in that court again?
Well, I think the lawyer probably runs a risk possibly every time that he disagrees with the trial judge in a county.
I think that's comparable to you.
What if he should have to mandamus a trial judge?
Counsel,
yes,
did I understand your point that he should have filed the writ of mandamus without waiting to see if the record would be filed on the last date, to wit, the 24th? Was that the point you were making just before the interruption?
I was surprised that he did not file an application for mandamus at the same time he filed that third motion to extend time. You see, up until that point, the Austin Court of Civil Appeals did not know anything about Mr. Baker's illness, about his nose surgery.
But aren't you talking about only 3 or 4 days there? Was the writ of mandamus, application for writ of mandamus, or application for leave to file a writ of mandamus filed within 3 or 4 days after the 24th?
No, sir. The statement of facts was due on July 24th, 1980. The third motion to extend time was dated, I believe, July 26th, and I believe filed July 28th of 1980.
Okay, I see. Yeah.
The Austin Court of Civil Appeals waited until August the 26th before they took any action, over 1 month, and I emphasize that, over 1 month, I believe 31 days, before they took any action, and at that time, they overruled the third motion to extend time. The application for mandamus was filed under date of September 8th, and I believe it was filed on September the 9th, 1980. It appears to me, though, that the appellants had a burden here, that they had a burden of going ahead and complying and not trying to second-guess the Austin Court of Civil Appeals and going ahead and filing that application for mandamus. Then they would be relieved of that responsibility. Then that court could determine at that time whether or not he should be mandamus, whether he should be fined or whatever. And they've met their responsibility. But what we have here are the appellants trying to second guess, I suppose, the Court of Civil Appeals sitting here in Austin. And
I'm
think we should...
Excuse me, I apologize. I cut you off.
When?
Well, I'll proceed. Let us assume that the Court of Civil Appeals is ready to mandamus somebody.
Yes.
What does the Court of Civil Appeals do other than say, get this record in here by a certain date? Does the Court of Civil Appeals have power to put somebody in jail?
I think he would be in
contempt. To fine them?
Does it have prior authority to take testimony, or is the court reporter not entitled to be heard at all? Why he shouldn't be put in jail?
I think he's entitled to.
So what you're saying is the Court of Appeals would take testimony, swear the witnesses?
I think he's
prepare a record on the record.
Entitled to show cause before someone held him in contempt. On the first appeal of this case, Mr. Prosperi is right. It took a year, and granted it did. And we were having the same problem, but when Justices Dyes and Keith and Clayton told us to jump, we jumped. And we did what we were supposed to. And that is obvious because that record was eventually filed. And when they made a suggestion to us, and I want to tell you that's outside the record, but it's been brought into this thing. And that record was eventually filed in the Beaumont Court, and that appeal was eventually heard. And just from that fact alone, you must know that we did comply with their suggestions and directions, and we did do what they told us to. It appears to me that the fault in the application for writ of error is pointed at the court reporter, and true, it is the court reporter's fault. The error is pointed at the Court of Civil Appeals sitting here in Austin. But the nitty-gritty of this situation is July 2nd, 1980, when the Austin Court of Civil Appeals asked them to file that application for mandamus, and they did not do it. And then July 28th came and went when they filed that third motion to extend time, and there's something else that comes into play here. On that second motion to extend time, Mr. Baker had said in his affidavit, number one, there's no indication that he had started the statement of facts, but number two, that there were two criminal cases in front of us, a Harris case and another case, and that he had started the other case. In that third motion to extend time, he sets out six total cases. The Harris case has disappeared from the affidavit. I don't know what happened to it. It was a criminal case. But he's still working on the same criminal case, and there are five other cases, and I believe there are pleas of privilege have been moved in front. And we talk about the illness of Mr. Baker, but that illness was not known to the Austin Court of Civil Appeals and didn't appear anywhere in the transcript or the affidavits or anywhere else until September the 9th, 1980.